everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, a special edition. This is actually a sequel because last week we had What to Do When Disaster Strikes. And we had one of the largest audience, if not the largest audience, for Progressive Radio Network, which has a huge audience to begin with. A lot of people had questions. Unfortunately, I was so tied into doing the commentary that there was no time for any feedback. But today, I'm setting aside a lot of time for feedback. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. I'm sitting here with a flashlight at my desk at my home, which is a ranch in Southwest Florida. I'm fortunate. I feel blessed because though there was a severe storm, my home was not damaged, nor the animals that I oversee and keep and help and get back their health and then try to find them homes and sanctuaries, nor my small staff. That can't be said for a lot of homes, a lot of homeowners and people in Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. But before we go to the problems that I see and the solutions, and I'm hopeful that you also offer your input on solutions to this dynamic of global warming and excessive weather patterns, more than 122,000 in the last year, over 12,000 in the United States, meaning the hottest day, the coldest day, the most rain in one day, just like this recent storm in Harvey, more rain poured down in that storm than in any storm in American history. In fact, 2.5 years worth of rain in 4 days. And yet that will be the new norm. That's my concern. It's different when you're in the middle of a crisis, when you are there, when you're on the ground. Talk with someone who was in Vietnam, who went into the villages that had been napalmed, who saw the charred bodies of innocent civilians, the people who never picked up a weapon, couldn't point out the United States on a map for anything. They were simply peaceful, agrarian farmers. Now, that gives you a different idea of cause and effect when you're there. The same is true when you're touring in Afghanistan. It's not a conscript. It's a volunteer army. And also in Iraq. And then even in Syria now, we have people. And then when you're there, you get a different perspective. I was fortunate enough to be told about some veterans who were in the woods in Florida. And I thought, well, how many? 5, 10? No, a lot. I didn't know how many a lot was, and I didn't know why they were there. I'd not heard about it. So a friend drove me over, and I took a camera. I have a camera crew, and the crew and I walked through the woods, and not far, maybe 100 yards in, there was one little pup tent. And it was one of those little pup tents where a guy who was about 6'3", the bottom half of his body was outside the tent, and he had all these mosquito bites all over his legs. The top part was okay. It was inside. And he saw me, and, you know, he kind of woke up. And it was interesting because he had neatly folded his T-shirts and his shorts on one side of the pup tent, and he had one can of beans on the other side. And I didn't know if there was anybody else. Or anybody else? Oh, yeah, about another 30 feet back. And then there was a large circle of vets. And right in the middle was a gigantic 6 foot high, about 15 foot wide beer cans. And those guys were drinking all day. I said, what's this about? They said, well, we have no place to go, no money to get there. And so this is how we spend our time. I said, how many more of you? Oh, there are lots. Well, there turned out to be 16,000. Let me repeat that. 16,000 homeless vets living around Titusville. They would walk about anywhere from 1 mile to 4 miles to a place, a little place called the Daily Bread that I support. send them money so they can buy food for the homeless, including homeless vets. They would have a meal, they could get a shower, and then they'd walk back. But on the way back, there was a veterans park. If they stopped, as one did, to read a book sitting in Veterans Park, they could get arrested. Because even though they were veterans, all, they were not allowed because they were also homeless. And that was near Orlando and Cape Coral. Not long after me finding all these people and hearing their stories, one thing became apparent. Most would suffer from what we would consider today post-traumatic stress disorder. And as I began to gain their confidence, and fortunately some of them knew who I was, had heard me on radio or watched on PBS specials, they then felt open that they could trust me. And there was also one that was an activist on their behalf. Guy wore this big cowboy hat, tall guy, about 6'6". And he was going over to Tallahassee, the capital, to lobby on their behalf. In any case, they had no advocates. I mean, they really were on their own. And they told me what it was like when you're in the middle of a crisis every day, but the world doesn't know about your crisis, how you're feeling, what you're observing, your reality. As one man said, you have no idea what it's like when you go into a person's home at 2 o'clock in the morning, knock down their door, terrify everyone, and then someone gets shot. It's an accident. Now you got to cover it up. And he said, and sometimes it wasn't an accident. He said he saw people get shot, kids getting shot, and though he had not shot anyone himself, he said, the code is you can't do anything about it. You can't turn in your own buddies. He said he saw everything that he never thought existed. It was a reality that he simply couldn't live with. And then when he got out, he was so psychologically challenged and so raging inside that he lost his family and ended up coming down to Florida, mainly because it was just warmer and it was wintertime. If you're going to be poor and homeless, better be poor and homeless where it's warmer rather than colder. I heard hundreds of stories. I spoke with over, I'm guesstimating in groups throughout my several visits there, probably close to about 700 people. Now, I tell you that for a simple reason. To see something happening like a tornado, a earthquake, a fire, a hurricane that is a velocity hitting that we have not seen in a given area. It's one thing when you see it from the protection of your home as a passive spectator. But it's also disturbing. I remember writing editorials against Vietnam War, and I really took umbrage with the idea that people were looking at the Vietnam War like, you know, John Wayne goes to war. And they didn't give a damn. The average American could care less, just like they could care less about McCarthyism, unless they were one of the victims. And then about 5 years into the war, suddenly their daughter or son came back injured or in a body bag. Suddenly it became very personal. And I wrote about why is it we have to wait till something's personal and catastrophic in the loss before we decide to pay attention to it. And that's what we're faced with today on the entire planet. Now, we'll have conferences like the Paris meetings, but before then, there are about every 2 or 3 or 4 years, there'll be another one. They mean nothing. They're absolutely show events. You show up, you take your Democracy Now, you take a group over there. It makes you sound like you're important or that you're doing something significant. But the reality is absolutely positively nothing changes in a major way because of this. Koch brothers don't suddenly have a mea culpa and say, you know, you're right. Our industries are contributing massive amounts of pollution and greenhouse gases, and that's creating global warming and making all this mess worse. Let's change. It's very easy for a Secretary of State or a president to look presidential and show up and make some platitudes, but it means nothing. Because the very people who are going to be giving this president, when he gets out of office, hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars for a speech about nothing, he knows that he's not going to force change. Everything's superficial. But everybody's got their talking points, so they sound literate and functional. But nothing happens. Even Al Gore, and I really support his efforts to show the impact of global warming. I think he's done a very good job there, and I commend him on that. The fact that the only company he showed doing solar was one that he has investments in, and he didn't tell people he's a partner in a $7 billion hedge fund. So do they want to end global warming? Absolutely, providing they can profit from it. Not a word did you see anything about wave power or geothermal power. And yet he was close enough to focus on that. He was in Greenland. So in effect, you show the problem, but then the solution becomes proprietary and profitable. Once again, it's disaster capitalism at its best. And even showing you his home, it looks like you're turning into a little country road, a dirt road. What you're not seeing is a huge, huge mansion, and it uses 20 times the power. Well, if you've got that kind of money and influence, you could certainly put in there, you could put in solar in a heartbeat. And flying on private jets, you don't see, but carrying your own luggage through an airport on a commercial flight, you do. All staged, everything's staged. And not a word about, let's give up meat. Why? Well, how many head of cattle has he grown, raised, and taken to market on his farm down in Tennessee? So there are a lot of half-truths about the environment out there, but very few full truths. So when you suddenly are that person who has no place to go, when you have no home, it's been destroyed, or damaged beyond repair, or damaged where you could repair, but the insurance doesn't cover it. Because when water hits your roof and runs off, if it then floods into the house, which it will, that damage is not covered. If it should tear off your roof, then you lose stuff because of the drench from having no roof. Oh, that'll cover it. That's a tiny fraction. And you look back at Hurricane Sandy. 5 years now, 80% of the claims have not been finalized. People still don't have homes. And those who did prided themselves on going back and rebuilding in the same place. And this is what you hear constantly. Well, we lost everything. This fire, it was all around you for about 5 days. Yeah, yeah. But then we lost everything. Everything. Clothes, furniture, everything. I mean, everything. You didn't think maybe you should rent a trailer? Every American that has a home and a car should have a simple hitch. And I just bought a trailer an hour ago. Because the one I had, I loaned it out, and other people needed it. And it was, you know, $600, not expensive, with a hitch, 2-inch hitch. And then you can put everything you need that's of value, and you can make several trips, run it out to where the storm's not going to be. You got time, but we won't do that. The vast majority of people will not do that. The question is why? I wrote an article about this, and I did a broadcast, a commentary years ago called Watching Katrina. Now, my radio show was broadcast in New Orleans. I've been to New Orleans many, many, many times. It's a wonderful environment. I love the people down there. The food's some of the tastiest, spiciest, interesting food, including for vegans, you can find in America. The music is tops. Just love the environment of walking down the street that people walked down 250 years ago in the French Quarter. And yet, they had 5 days to watch a Category 5 storm come right at them. And look at how few people actually either walked away, could have gotten on a bike and driven away, could have gotten in a car, could have gotten a van. There could have been something done, and it wasn't. The city was not prepared. The mayor was not prepared. The federal government was not prepared. The state wasn't. Nobody was prepared, and yet it was right there. Why? They weren't prepared for Sandy. I know. Because even our sister station, WBAI, when I was calling them all day, and saying, you're invited to come up. I've got extra engineers. I've set up cots. I'm going to provide you with food and beverage and phones and desks. I can have at least 20 of you. Go keep your work going here. I'm going to give my staff a 2 weeks off, and we'll put even the Progressive Radio Network programs on pre-record. I was told no thanks. In fact, the final call I made that evening around 7 o'clock, it was not a pleasant call. They were very rude. Okay, fine, until they went off the air, until everything I told them was going to happen happened, to when they looked out the window and couldn't get out of the building because the water was up above the streetlight, which was 20 feet or thereabouts. And then they came up and for a couple months used our studio, as they did after 9/11. So people are very, very resistant to preparing or to change. So that brings us to, I'm going to share a commentary from Chris Hedges, but also I want to share a few other things here with you. This is from Juan Cole from Informed Comment. Governor Rick Scott enabled Irma's fury through climate denialism and should resign. Quote, Florida Governor Rick Scott did not cause Irma, but he enabled the Frankenstorm. Before becoming governor in 2011, Scott had been an entrepreneur who, quote, specialized in privatizing health care and ran a hospital chain convicted of a massive health care fraud. Scott met with the carbon mongers Charles and David Koch soon after being elected, and all of a sudden Florida's environmental laws began being gutted. Now we will want you to give him $150 billion, by the way, it's now up to $200 billion, to rebuild his state from your tax dollars. He and his ilk argued that it is less expensive to deal with a changing climate than to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. Scott enabled Irma's unusual severity by opposing measures to reduce carbon emissions. He even started replying to climate change questions by saying, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a scientist either, but I took eighth grade chemistry and know what a greenhouse gas is. Scott opposed a high-speed train in Central Florida, which would have cut down on automobile use and forestalled thousands of tons of CO2 emissions. Scott told Florida state employees not to use the term climate change. That included scientists working for the state. Our current head of an anti-EPA, Scott Pruitt, has taken over the Scott policy and applied it to the entire federal government. Pruitt thinks that it is disrespectful to the victims of Harvey and Irma to talk about climate change. Actually, it is disrespectful to the victims to victimize them with carbon dioxide and methane emissions. Scott backed measures that punished Floridians of all people for having solar panels on their roofs. Florida is like Disney World for solar power. Scott's Neanderthal policy was overturned by a popular referendum only last year. Instead, in 2015, Florida sued the federal government, along with 23 other states, quote, over a plan to reduce carbon emissions nationally, claiming the law will increase electric rates. Yeah, right, because free sunshine and wind are more expensive than pricey coal and natural gas. Scott has been a creature of big oil, covered in liquid tar, like a monster hiding out in a swamp, and the fumes he has put off have summoned Irma. Floridians emit 227 million metric tons of carbon dioxide every year, over 4% of the United States' national output. It therefore played a role in making Irma into an incredible Hulk. And Scott has prevented the emission reductions for six straight years. And remember that he has had a national impact through influence on other governors and his suit against President Obama. Scott's contribution to the destructiveness of this storm is relatively small, but it actually is large enough to be quantified. And since he is helping wreck, but I will be taking your calls in just about maybe 10 minutes. And that number to call in if you'd like to ask questions or make comments is 888-874-4888. In any case, that was Juan Cole's commentary on the governor of Florida. And yet he was out there making himself seen in every single television spot about how heroic, and look at him, and he cares. That's that half-truth again. That's that kind of Al Gore shuffle. Now, remember what I said at the beginning about those veterans living in Florida? The state didn't care about them. The communities didn't care about them. They actually criminalized being poor. And I saw a man it was about 8 o'clock in the morning. It was in February, and it was cold. It was around 40 degrees, and all he had on was a T-shirt. He was a vet, and he was sleeping under a tree. He didn't have a tent, didn't have a sleeping bag. And when I walked over to him and I offered him a blanket, he was very grateful, and I struck up a whole conversation. He was a young guy, and he said he was waiting for the stand down, which is where the vets come together once a year, and other vets donate their time to, give them a haircut or give them sleeping bags, things that they can use. And I'm thinking, wow, what would we do if we suddenly realized there were 16,000 men and women living in dire poverty, living in environmental extremes, cold or rainy, and no one knew about it, and the state knew about it and didn't care? And then you talk with them and they say what they experienced is different than what you see on television. So what I'm saying is, more and more, it's not what you're going to be experiencing on television, it's what you're going to be experiencing in real life. Just today, this afternoon, Mexico had its second 7.1 earthquake in under 9 days. That's never happened in the country's history before. But then again, we've never had two Category 4s hurricanes hit the United States or its territory at the same time in our history. That's the new norm. And we've never had an entire state on fire, Montana, and no news coverage of it. That's never happened before. So this is the new norm. Now I'm going to digress for a moment. I went down to Jamaica to do a report. It was two-faced. One was, what was the impact of the World Trade Organization and Bill Clinton's policies? And by the way, they were devastating to the environment down there and to people's economy, because Jamaicans had been historically self-sufficient. There's a whole area and off the Blue Ridge Mountains down towards Ocho Rios and north of Kingston, where they have just hundreds of farms growing everything. But Clinton, under NAFTA, was able to export Idaho potatoes into Jamaica cheaper than what the people in Jamaica could grow their own potatoes. And they did the same thing with rice for Haiti. So not only were the people there disinclined to buy their own homegrown products, because they were getting subsidized. The world didn't know about this. But when I spoke with people who had boarded up their farms because nobody wanted to buy their product, they could get an American imported product cheaper. But what struck me, and I want you to think about this for a moment, is the Minister of Tourism gave me a call. I met with him. And he was really up on Jamaica. And the people of Jamaica are wonderful, and it's called the Jewel of the Caribbean for a good reason. It's just breathtaking. And he had this woman take me around. And she wanted to take me, and I'd already been to Port Antonio and all the beautiful places. And I said, I'd like for you to take me into the inner areas. And she wouldn't do it. She said, oh, no, we're very peaceful. You know, people love the government. And you talk about karma. Just as he said that, we're on a street, and down the street comes a whole group of people, and they were protesting the abysmal wages paid by the hotels. And they were banging on her car. She had actually, I can get out and give some people some money so we could go on our way. I'm just sitting there thinking, man, this was perfect. So I finally had her pull back to my hotel, and I left her. And I walked off to the beach, and the first thing you notice is that if you're going to go in the water, suddenly there's 10 people want to go in the water with you to protect you from whatever, riptide, sharks. There's no riptide there, but the sharks, even though they have shark nets. And then when you get out, they want to give you a towel, even though you have a towel from the hotel. And everywhere you turn, you can't take a step without someone hustling you. And unless you're in a very exclusive one, well, they won't do that. The big, giant ones do. So I told the guy, I said, I'll tell you what. If you're willing to spend some time showing me around, I'll be more than happy to pay for your service. Okay, good. So he took me across the street, right across the street from the hotel. And he showed me these houses that, by any measure, you would never let it. There were no windows. There were mosquitoes. They were put tin roofs. They were boiling hot. There was no sanitation. And yet these were the people who would put on their white short-sleeved shirts and they're putting on their little black bow tie and their black pants and black shoes and go to work across the street in the hotels. And I said, how many? He said, everyone. As far as we can walk, all these people work in the hotels. And I said, but these hotels make a lot of money. They're always packed, but they don't share any of that profit with us. So then I got someone to take me up to the top of a hill so I could really get a view. And then I scoped out that any kind of major storm is going to wipe all these people out. It won't wipe out the hotels because they're built to hurricane code and they're big structures, concrete with steel pilings and all. But all the other homes, there's not going to be nothing left of them. And then I went down to the farmer's market, and there's the fishmongers, and then there's the women who will go out and buy they open up burlap bags and pour the fish out on the dock, and the women bid on them, and then they take them back, and then $2, they sit on a little stool under a tin roof, held up by four poles, and they dis and trail, they take out the guts, and then they shake it in some water. And then people come from the restaurants and buy this stuff. There's no big fish because it's all been fished out. Almost all the fish anybody eats in Jamaica comes from other countries, including the United States. But that's also true in Puerto Rico. It's just not advertised because what would it mean if almost all the food that you eat had to be brought in? What if you weren't growing any of your own, unless it's somewhere in your backyard? But these are big industries. And that's how it works. Everything's frozen or brought in. And so I then had a chance to speak with the only holistic doctor I know of, at least in Jamaica. And there was a mansion that was available up on top of a mountain. He wanted me to look at it to see if I thought that it was worth him buying and moving his clinic up there. And I took a look at it, and it was indeed beautiful. It was De Weirs or Duars. Anyhow, it's the old liquor family, and it was a beautiful estate on about 13 acres, but its top point at nighttime was breathtaking, and they wanted too much money. I said, I wouldn't invest in this. He said, why not? I said, sooner or later, this entire economy is going to collapse. Sooner or later, no one's going to have any money because the government is so corrupt, and it is under the thumb of all these other governments. It's deeply in debt, and look at the people. You know, the average Jamaican can't come to see you. They don't have the money. And you're not expensive. You're a nice guy. You help people. I said, the whole policy of how we treated the entire Caribbean, I've been to every island, St. Croix, St. John, St. Lucia, U.S. Virgin Islands, all of them, Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic and all of them, and Cuba, Jamaica, been all these places. And what you see is, all the money that does go in goes in for development or extraction of resources. Nothing, not a penny, goes in to help the people. As a result, now you see with this storm, when entire islands were destroyed, the whole island destroyed. Even Branson, the Virgin Air CEO, he's a billionaire. His home, gone. He can afford to, rebuild someplace else. So all the while people were going to these resorts, you had to drive through miles of dire poverty. on roads that nobody would spend a nickel on. They're like suicide. I mean, how these cars don't wreck all the time and kill people is beyond me, because the roads are so narrow. Not a penny spent on those roads. Not a penny spent on public housing to improve people's quality of life. Not a penny extra given to these people who won't make hundreds of millions of dollars a year in profit off their resorts. But then it gets down to the people themselves. If you're going through dire poverty, you go into a gated community, every single one of those communities everywhere has guys with shotguns. All you have to do is look for them and you'll see them. They're discreet, but they're there. Because they want the people with money not being hassled, and they want everyone else who lives there, who's only engaged in service work, to stay out. And so it's all an illusion. Everything's an illusion. Cuba's an illusion. I don't have time now to tell you the truth about Cuba and Castro and what really goes on there, including rampant racism that everyone on the left seems to deny, until you go there. Be in my shoes. Go there with the intent of looking for the truth, and you'll find it. Go to a place wanting just to hang out and have daiquiris all day and massage on a beach and, you know, a wonderful meal and be with your lover, and you'll come back thinking it's the greatest place in the world. But you didn't stop for one moment. They told you not to go outside the gate. They took you and on tours where the tour place they took you are guarded, and nobody wants to screw around with that income. But now go one foot off the beaten path, and that's also true in virtually, I would say, 21 islands. It's true everywhere. So they only show you what they want to show you, and then you forget the rest of what you see. Well, then how much responsibility does a person have if what they're doing is paying corporations to continue to exploit people, and then when a storm comes and you see these people are drowned or their homes are wiped away or they have no food or water, they have no toilets, that corporation is responsible for that, because when it was building that big, you know, 30-story, you know, resort on the ocean, it could have gone ahead and built living, nice quality living accommodations, schools, and everything else. They had the money to do it. They don't put a penny back. Unmitigated greed. The developers, the politicians, it's all one massive con. So now multiply that everywhere in the world. Go down to Miami Beach. You want to talk about a place that can make your skin creep? Spend some time down there now. Every other person's a hustler. More pathological liars. I didn't think you could find more pathological liars than Beverly Hills and Hollywood. This you can't. I don't believe anything anyone says in that part of Florida. Everyone's hustling. And they'll sell you anything, promising you everything's going to be cool. Well, what happens when, you know, it's not cool, when water goes up in the entire first floor of your building and the generator's on the floor and it gets flooded out? What happens then? How do you cope with that? What happens when that's the new norm? What happens when the roads are going to be flooding every night from tidal surge? What happens when you finally have enough people get out of this trance and look and think, wow, I invested in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people. That makes me the wrong person. Then either get out or you lose. I predict one of the largest exoduses in American history over the next 2 years. It won't happen now. It's going to take a smackdown again where you get hit with a Category 5, and this then looks like a mild hurricane compared to what's coming. I'm telling you now, if you don't get out in a reasonable and responsible way, then you're going to face more of these disasters. Houston's going to face more, but Houston created this environment, this mess, this sprawl without end, the development without end, no planning, no what happens, no worst case scenario, nothing. Whatever you wanted to do, you could do it. Well, now you see the consequences. If you're really rich, it doesn't bother you. You can get on a plane and get out of there. You always have another place, and even if you had to lose what you have, it's not going to impact you. But if you're the other 98%, it does. On the other hand, people from all across America are going down there to get work, and they'll have work for a while. So that's the problem. The problem is that this is a condition worldwide. Now, mind you, there wasn't a word of discussion about it. Let's take a look at the people suffering in Bangladesh and in India. 41 million made homeless. 41 million. That's more than live in the entire state of California. Made homeless. And nothing about it. No discussion. And two of the hottest days in American or world history since records were kept occurred in the last month. Not a word about it. It's only when it's a big news event, and the moment it's over, the news goes away, and everything then is about cleaning up. If you've planned for a storm, then you can survive it. But what about the next one? Because they're only going to get worse, because global warming is increasing, not decreasing. And as the temperature goes up and the water goes up, there's going to be more water sucked up and more ferocious storms. So you either adapt to that, or you get out of the way and find a place. Now, there are a lot of good places. One of the nicest places in the world to live is Ireland. Portugal is good also. Inexpensive, wonderful people. Ireland has plenty of water, nice soil, nice people. Scotland's also good, though it can be harsh depending upon where you live. And there are places that, you know, right now you could actually buy in France, you could actually buy a chateau, a hotel, beautiful, functional. If it were in the United States, if it were out on Long Island, you're looking at about $50 to $60 million. There it's $1.5 million. Beautiful mansions for $500,000 to $600,000. And yet we think that, you know, $500,000 to $600,000 is an average cost. And if you're near the water, well, forget it. We've lost our sense of perspective. So we shouldn't any longer be in harm's way. We should have the common sense to get out of the way. Just like watching Katrina, a lot more people could have left. I went back and talked with them, and they acknowledged it. Everybody had an excuse. And you see the results of that, except for those people who were not able to get out, and that was only about 2%. But the rest could have and should have. So look around the United States. Where are there not floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes? You've got about 14 states. The high end would be places would be up around the Canadian border, Wisconsin, New Hampshire, Maine, Northwest Massachusetts, Northwest New York State, Northwest Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee, Northeast North Carolina, and then I would have said in the past Oregon and Washington State. I wouldn't now because they're having all kinds of environmental problems there, and they're on an earthquake fault line that's going to happen sooner or later. So there are places to move. There are progressive communities to move to. There are quality schools. There's quality of life. You just have to do your homework. I wrote an article about it. It's free. It's 60-some pages up on my website. You can download it. Best places to live. And there's a whole lot of metrics considered. You know, the number of jobs available. You don't want to be around high-density population centers because when people don't have food and water, they can get really nasty when they otherwise might be completely civilized. And what happens if we get hit by a solar storm? And if you think not, then you got to read the conversation. It says, quote, if you still have your solar viewing glasses, and it goes on to talk about massive sunspots and huge solar flares mean unexpected space weather for Earth. And it means that it's more than likely going to happen in the very near future, but we're not prepared for it. And our grids are not going to change. Now, mind you, if we really cared about people, here's what we would have done. We would have had gigantic industrial generators on flatbed trucks, 1,000 of them, and put in every major city, making sure that people had power. We then would have had emergency portable vehicles for people who, nursing homes and hospice care, hospitals, could have had a place with air conditioning and medical attention. We would have had 10 to 15 million gallons of water sent ahead, so every single person knew that there was a place to get water. There was over 24 million people in Florida alone left without power, meaning no water, gasoline. So if you put the gasoline and water there, you're doing a great service. If you put food in those same centers, we didn't do any of this. We come in afterwards, like the National Guard's here, okay? Got water, you got food, got a way to get me out of here? Nope. Just making sure no one steals. We're not even doing the basics. This is something that we, the people, have to demand. If we don't demand it, the politicians will not enact it. The local governments, the federal governments, and the state governments fail consistently. And look at the pattern. They failed with Katrina, they failed with Sandy, and they failed with these. And they're going to continue to, because it's all about the politics. They don't care at all how much they spend on worthless military industrial complex projects. They do care about how much they give to, you know, a state in this way. And it's not about building some seawall. This is not Denmark. It's about realizing we shouldn't be living any longer in non-sustainable environments. We can argue that if we can afford to, then we should have a right to. And I'm going to say, if you build on the ocean and your home's destroyed and you keep rebuilding it and it keeps getting destroyed, then we should stop rebuilding it. You have to be responsible at some point for the choices you make. And yet we don't want that. We want to have the right to make our choices, but when we make a mistake, we want someone else to pay for it. And boy, that's a problem. So the government's not going to change. People are not going to change. So then stop looking for these people to make it all better. They're not going to. And we should be aware of that. Now, let's take a look at the Great Flood. How many times will we rebuild Florida cities in Houston and coastal New Jersey and New Orleans or other population centers ravaged by storms lethally intensified by global warming? According to Chris Hedges, at what point, surveying the devastation and knowing more is inevitable, will we walk away, leaving behind fast coastal dead zones, or retreat even further into magical thinking to cope with the fury we have unleashed from the natural world? Or will we be responding rationally and radically altering our relationship with this earth that gives us life? Civilizations over the past 6,000 years have unfailingly squandered their futures through acts of colossal stupidity and hubris. We are probably not an exception. The physical ruins of these empires, including, Mesopotamia, the Roman, Mayan, Indus, litter the earth. They elevated, during acute distress, inept and corrupt leaders who challenged anger in a way that was self-serving, using fear and dwindling resources into self-defeating wars and vast building projects. Now, the ruling oligarchs, driven by greed and hedonism, retreated into privileged compounds, the Forbidden City, Versailles, and hoarded wealth as their populations endured mounting misery and poverty. And the worse it got, the more the people lied to themselves, and the more they wanted to be lied to. Reality was too painful to confront. They retreated into what anthropologists call crisis cults, which promised the return of the lost world through magical beliefs. And the most significant characteristic of modern civilization is the sacrifice of the future for the present. and all the power of science has been prostituted in this purpose. That's according to William James. So, we are entering, like it or not, the final phase of civilization, one in which we are slashing the budgets of the very agencies that are vital to prepare for the devastation ahead. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administrations, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, along with programs at the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, dealing with climate change. Hurricane after hurricane, monster storm after monster storm, flood after flood, wildfire after wildfire, drought after drought will gradually cripple the empire, draining the wealth and the resources and creating swaths of territory defined by lawlessness and squalor. Cities across the globe, including London, Shanghai, Rio, Mumbai, Lagos, Copenhagen, New Orleans, San Francisco, Savannah, Georgia, and New York City will continue modern-day versions of Atlantis, along with countries such as Bangladesh and the Marshall Islands and large parts of New Zealand and Australia. There are 90 coastal megacities in the United States that endure chronic flooding, a number that is expected to double in the next just 20 years, and the national economies will go into tailspins as wider and wider parts of the globe suffer catastrophic systems breakdown. And central authority and basic services will increasingly be non-existent. Hundreds of millions of people desperate for food and water and security will become climate refugees. Nuclear power plants, including Turkey Point, which is on the edge of Biscayne Bay, south of Miami, will face meltdowns, such as the accident that occurred in Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan after it was destroyed by an earthquake and a tsunami. These plants will spew radioactive waste into the sea and air, exacerbated by disintegration of the polar ice caps. And the catastrophes will be too overwhelming to manage. We will enter what James Howard Kunstler calls the long emergency. When that happens, our experiment in civilization might approach an end. The amount of real estate at risk in New York is mind-boggling. 72,000 buildings worth over $129 billion are now in a flood zone today. That's today, as I speak, with thousands more buildings at risk with each foot of sea level rise. In addition, New York has all that property, every inch of it being overdeveloped down on the docks. And that is just the beginning of it. Remember, New York is at sea level, and hence any rise in the sea is going to impact lower Manhattan. And because of changes in ocean dynamics, as well as the fact that the ground beneath the city is sinking as the continent recovers from the last ice age, seas are now rising about 50% faster in the New York area than the global average. A society in crisis flees to the reassuring embrace of con artists and charlatans, and critics who ring alarm bells are condemned as pessimists who offer no hope, the drug that keeps the doomed population passive. And the current administration, which removed Barack Obama's climate action platform, the White House website as soon as Donald Trump took office, and the Republican Party are filled with happy climate deniers. They have adopted a response to climate change similar to that of the Virginia legislature's ban. Discussion of climate change and is not allowed. You know, you can only say recurrent flooding. So droughts and floods and famines and disease will eventually see the collapse of social cohesion in large parts of the globe, including the U.S. coastal areas. So the insecurity, the hunger, I saw that this week at restaurants where there were fights, filling stations where there, even with four different cop cars there people were fighting. So just imagine when there's no police, and imagine when there's no gas. And this kind of desperation among the dispossessed of the earth will give rise to ad hoc militias and crime and increase active terrorism. The Pentagon report called an abrupt climate change scenario and its implications for the United States security is blunt. Quote, disruption and conflict will be endemic features of life. That's a grim conclusion. But, as we have heard, the trolls will continue. From John McCain to Newt Gingrich and Sean Hannity, they'll continue to say it's all nonsense. If Americans have difficulty reaching a reasonable compromise on immigration and legislation today on that, consider what such a debate would be like if we were struggling to resettle millions of our own citizens driven by high water from the Gulf of Mexico and South Florida and much of the East Coast, reaching nearly to New England, even as we witness the northward migration of large populations from Latin America and the Caribbean. Now, such migrations will likely be one of the Western Hemisphere's early social consequences of climate change and sea level rise of these orders of magnitude and issues deriving from the inundation of a large amount of our own territory, together with migration towards our borders by millions of our hungry and thirsty southern neighbors. That's all likely to dominate the U.S. security and humanitarian concerns. And globally as well, populations will migrate from increasingly hot and dry climates to more temperate ones. We will react like most patients with a terminal disease as they struggle to confront their imminent mortality. The gradual diminishing of space, perception, and strength will weaken our capacity to absorb reality. The end will be too horrible to contemplate. The tangible signs of our demise will be obvious. But this will only accelerate our retreat into delusional thinking. We will believe every more fervently that the secular gods of science and technology will save us. They will not. The water will continue to rise, no matter what we believe politically. The damage suffered from Houston and Tampa and Miami is not an anomaly. It's the beginning of the end. So, as grim as that is, I cannot do anything less than tell you the truth of how bad it is, but it's going to get a lot worse. We were lucky this time. You can say, how much luck is there when whole communities were without electricity and will be, and there's no water and it's uncomfortable, but you're alive, and at least your home's more often than not there. But that won't be the case in the future, so act accordingly. Start looking for safer, better, more sustainable places to live. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. There's too many of you to cry. Brother, brother, brother. There's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate.